Thank you. Thank you. What I'd like to do today is to paint a picture of the attractors that I talked about yesterday, the good ones, the ones that are that correspond to the good parameters. Now, I'm not going to tell you how I arrive at this picture. I'm not going to prove that the set of parameters corresponding to this picture is positive. Okay? I'm just going to tell you what the end picture looks like, sort of the ideal picture, as in Ilyushenko's talk. Okay? So this is the setting that I will be thinking about. So the phase space is now a one-dimensional space, which you can think of as the circle or an interval across a disk. This is an n-1 dimensional disk. Okay? And I have a map that takes this phase space into itself. It's an embedding. Okay. This map is rank 1 in the following sense. Okay. I'm going to write the coordinates of this map as t1 through tm. And the first coordinate, which I think of as in the horizontal direction, is the direction where something, where the action may happen, where the map is sometimes expanding, sometimes contracting. Okay. And in all the other directions, t2 up to tm is contracting. So if I set all the other T1 with a bracket up there, denotes the map where I set the rest of them to 0. Okay? So T1, this map here now, is a map from an m-dimensional space to a one-dimensional space. Okay? And rank 1 means that the whole map, T, minus that, the difference is very small. Okay? So in other words, T2, the second to mth coordinates are very small. And the first one, it could be anything. Okay? And by attractor, all that I meant is that you take the, since the map takes takes M into itself, so each iterate it gets smaller, and the intersection is what I will call the attractor. Okay? And I'm interested in a situation where the map restricted to the attractor has some hyperbolic behavior. But a very controlled kind of hyperbolic behavior. So here's a picture to keep in mind. This one, everyone is familiar with. You take a solid torus, so here in this picture, m is equal to 3. Okay. Yes, m is equal to 3. Sorry, this m is equal to 3. The phase space is equal to circle cross a disk, so a solid 3 torus. Okay. And if the map was z going to z squared, then you simply take this solid torus and map it around, and this is the standard solenoid that we have all known and loved for a long time. Okay. Now, the difference between what I'm doing and this case, this uniformly hyperbolic case, is that this map is now replaced by an arbitrary one-dimensional map. So imagine that instead of going around twice, it could go around, turn around, so many times, whatever you like. Okay, so that's the picture. And so if it turns around at all, it will not be uniformly hyperbolic. The uniformly hyperbolic case corresponds to when it's uniformly ex when this one-dimensional map is uniformly expanding. So I will be looking at non-uniform hyperbolicity, but I'm looking for the good parameters. They are it's a situation that I would describe as controlled non-uniform hyperbolicity. It's more than just non-uniform hyperbolic, but it's more controlled than that. Okay. So now, the difference between thinking about the solenoid case and the case I'm looking at would be that because I have to deal with this non-uniform stuff, the turning around the situation is more complex. I have to use stronger contraction than in the XMA case. For the solenoid, there's no reason to have strong contraction. Now I would need it. Okay? And the second is that I have to toss a certain fraction of the parameters before I could handle these maps. Okay? But that's the setting for today's talk. Okay. I think you should for you should interrupt me as we go along. Otherwise, it would make more sense that way to have a kind of more of a discussion of what's going on. So the picture is now you have a one-dimensional map of a circle which goes like that. okay? And you thicken it up a little bit and form a map of a solid 3 torus into itself. If the contraction is strong enough, I will choose among these maps some good maps that I will give a fairly complete description of. Okay. So now the rest of the talk is going to be, you should think of it as a sequence of snapshots of the dynamical pictures of these maps. Okay. Sometimes a little bit disjointed, but just a sequence of snapshots from different angles that hopefully, you know, by the end of the hour will give you some feeling for what they look like. Okay. So the first thing, and the most prominent thing in a way, is that it really, because you contract down quite slowly, this one-dimensional map that winds back and forth is going to dominate the picture, and so there's a tendency to mimic one-dimensional behavior. So I want to identify the one-dimensional behavior that this n-dimensional map mimics. Okay, so this is like I'm only going to pick out a few properties that are important. Okay. So look at this one-dimensional map. Assume that it's expanding everywhere outside of this interval, and there's a critical point. So the question is, what happens if you have an orbit and it passes near this critical point? Okay. So since I'm trying to, the goal is to cultivate some kind of hyperbolicity or in one dimension expansion, and if it's outside of here, it's expanding, so it's not a problem. The problem is when it comes near to zero, there's going to be some serious setback because of the contraction, so what happens to it? And there's a single result about one dimension that you have to know, and it's this long, and it's the only thing you have to know about one-dimensional maps. Okay. So let me cover it up and talk about it a little bit more slowly. Okay. So there are two assumptions on this map. The first condition is due to Colle-Ekman, and it says that if you look at the critical orbit, its derivative grows exponentially. The derivative grows exponentially along the critical orbit. Okay. I have to take one iterate later. Zero is the critical point. I have to look at one iterate later, otherwise I always get zero, right? So the derivative just grows exponentially. Okay. Why do I want that? Because when you come near here, something bad happens, you want to compensate immediately afterwards. Okay. So this is the first condition. And the second condition is due to Benedict and Carlson. And it says that I don't want the critical orbit to come close to itself too quickly. Okay. So I've got to allow it to come near itself, but let's say the approach of Fn of 0 to n is very slow. Think of alpha as a very small number, 1 over 100, something like that. Okay. Then under these two conditions, the conclusion is that for every x that's near zero, there is a time, this is called a recovery time, which is it's roughly 1 over log x, with the property that during this period, the orbit of x follows the critical orbit very closely. Okay. It's following the critical orbit to this amount. Okay. To this order, this of closeness. Okay. Now, when it follows the critical orbit, it's going to copy the behavior of the critical orbit. Okay. And if the critical orbit is expanding, then it is going to be expanding too. It's going to copy the expanding behavior. Okay. And at the end of this recovery period, its derivative is e to the half lambda p. Lambda is the expansion of the critical orbit. It will have copied half of it. That's the claim. And it's the single unique result that you have to know for the whole thing. Okay. So this result, as written, is first proved in Benedict and Carlson. The ideas, however, were used by many people long before that. And I'm going to show you the proof. The proof is it can be turned into a real proof, even modulo some high order type of correction. Okay, so a proof is 2 lines long, it's this long, okay, and it goes like this, and you have to pay attention, otherwise it's over. The proof goes like this. Okay, so if x is a point near zero, okay, so if I look at f of x and f of minus f of zero, because it's quadratic, it's x squared, right? So x squared times, well, it follows that p times, so each time it grows like lambda, so it's e to the lambda p. So x squared times e to the lambda p, don't worry about constants, okay, is roughly how far apart these two points are at the end. And since that's when I stopped, that must be because it's rough, it has reached this number. Okay? Now, if I look at the derivative at the end, fp prime of x, okay, what is it? Well, the first time is very bad. You pick up a derivative of x. That's because it's a distance x from 0. And then it's e to the lambda p. Well, what is this? This I can write as x. I put half of it here and half of it outside. And the half of it here is exactly the square root of this. So it's e to the minus alpha p. And the other half, I'm left with that. And alpha is nothing compared to lambda, so that's what I'm left. Okay? This is the one proof I'm going to do. Okay? I'm going to come back to this transparency because this is the crux of it. Okay. So what? I cheated, right?
The first statement of the lemma.
P.
Assumption B. There
B.
Is a difference is greater than exponential.
Yes.
And
okay.
This holds for all n.
This holds for all n. Yeah.
And in the statement, we have the same difference for n replaced by I is smaller than a smaller exponential.
Where? Sorry. Oh, here. This one.
Yes.
This one. Oh, yes. Thank you. This is a good point. I need to. So, what is the significance of this sentence here? Is that it's close enough to for the derivatives to be comparable? Okay. So, how close is close enough for the derivative to be comparable? Well, if the critical point is here, and the orbit is here, if you want another point to be comparable to this, it should be very close to this, right? So this is e to the minus 2 alpha I. This is e to the minus alpha I. Mm-hmm. This is a square root. This is a square of this. This is a critical. This is a critical point. Is that okay? So what this says is that when you follow, you're going to be following the critical orbit. Okay, you're following the critical orbit so closely that the critical orbit may itself come back to the critical point, right? But when it comes near the critical point, the point it's following is much closer to the critical orbit than you are. I mean, as far as the this distance is concerned, these two points are the same. That's why you copy the derivative. Okay. Thank you I forgot to say that. Okay. So this is really the crux of the matter. If you could get the critical point to critical orbit to expand. Okay, and to come back to it slowly, then you take anything that starts from here, it will, well, if you start near zero, of course you will follow the orbit of zero, and the conclusion is at the end of, when it stops following it, it has already gained hyperbolicity. Okay. So this transparency will resurface in a little bit, because this is the kind of the crux of the matter. And so the way that one could think about critical orbit, think about any orbit, then is like this. So now suppose my map has the two conditions in the last transparency. I now take an arbitrary point. Okay? Here's how you could think about it. So you look at this axis means time. So when it's outside, let's say it starts outside. When it's outside, it's expanding, so no problem. Comes near zero. Okay. Immediately, the derivative takes a big dip because it's near zero. Okay. But then it starts to follow the critical orbit for some period of time, during which it recovers. And by the end of this p, it has recovered. Okay. Didn't expand as much as the critical orbit, but it recovered. Okay. It picked up half of the derivative. Okay. And then now it stays outside again. It continues to expand until the next time it comes near the zero again. And now it follows the critical orbit again until it, during the idea is that during this period when it's following the critical orbit, don't look at what it's doing. Trust the critical orbit just as a guide. Just follow it. Okay? And at the end, you've regained your derivative, even though there's an initial shock. Right? Then you recover. Okay? Only look at the end, and then you stay outside until the next time you come near, and again you trust the critical orbit to guide you along and do that. Okay? This is how the sort of psychologically how I see every single orbit that doesn't land directly on a critical point. Okay? So in particular, the set of good maps, okay, the set of good maps would be, very simply, the maps with those two conditions, with the Cole-Ekman and the Benedict-Carlson conditions. Okay. That would be what I consider to be the set of good maps in one dimension. And so in particular, the how do you get this set of good maps? Okay, so you build up the set of good maps inductively. If you look at maps that are good up to some point, and then you delete some parameters to make sure they're good up to some point, and then you delete some more parameters and make them better, and so on. So it's done inductively. And how does it? So in particular, this argument here, this picture here of what a typical orbit looks like, can be applied to a critical orbit. So suppose I'm going to build up this behavior of the critical orbit expanding. What do? Well, I look at a critical orbit, and this critical orbit is not allowed to come too close to itself too quickly. That means that the recovery period would be roughly alpha n. Okay. Notice that alpha is a small number. It's like 1 over 100. Okay. So at time n, the critical orbit copies the first alpha n of itself. Okay. That's how it's going. Okay? So it's a procedure when a critical orbit keeps replicating the first bit of itself. Okay? So you build it up, you make it expand, and then it comes back and it copies the first 100th and of itself, and then you go farther, and then you come back and copy the first beginning, first bit of itself. And that's how the whole theory is built up. Okay? So input more generally, there are k critical points. This is a special case. I talked about one critical point. More generally, there are k critical points. So there are. What I want to emphasize here is that there are two time scales. Okay. At time n, if you want to treat this orbit fn, if you want to treat fn of ci, okay, if it's outside doing something, then I don't care. Suppose it comes near the critical set. Okay. Now it wants to copy somebody. Okay. It wants to copy somebody, whoever it's near, right? How many iterates will it copy? It's going to copy alpha n piece of that, when alpha is a very small number. Okay. So there are two time scales. If you make all the critical orbits good up to time alpha n, then you can take any one of them and develop the expansion up to time n. So there's the time scale of alpha n and n here. Think of n as real time. To treat things at time n, you need all the critical orbits to be good up to time alpha n. That's kind of the main. That's the main point. Okay. So as I suggest that it's probably better if you start to complain about different things. Okay, so now I'm going to do the in one dimension, the story is like this. I'm going to take what is called a Misarevich this is the one dimensional story. Okay, I'm going to fix a good map. A good map is one where the critical orbits are all trapped outside in some expanding set. Okay, they're trapped at expanding periodic orbits or Cantor sets. Okay. And now I look at a set of all points that are quite near those, so I can rely on the estimates of this one guy. Okay? And then I insist that the critical orbits grow, Cole-Ekman condition. I insist that it doesn't come back to the critical set too quickly, Benedict-Carlson condition. And that's my set of good maps in one dimension. And that's the end of the story for one dimension as far as choosing good maps go. So now I try to do that in all dimensions. Okay. So, let me start with a Misarevich map, exactly the same way. So I try to copy these three lines now for my n-dimensional maps. So the first line I can copy. Okay. This one just says rank 1. Okay. It's very close to a one-dimensional map. Okay. This one says that the restriction to the one-dimensional map is very close to the Misarevich map. Okay, so there are two approximations. It's close to a one-dimensional map. As the one-dimensional map is close to the one that I started with, that's fine. The third one is the non-degeneracy condition. Don't worry about it till later. Okay. But now I try to say A and B. And what's the big problem? The big problem is, what's the critical set? Yeah. There is no critical set. Right? It's an embedding. It's a diffeomorphism. There is no critical point around. Okay? So what I would like to say is that this is what I green kind of means, that I want to say these things, but I'm kind of not quite allowed to. That so I want to say that a good set corresponding to this Misarevich map is the set of maps that are rank 1 and close to this map and so on. Okay, plus these two things, that the critical orbits expand and they don't come near the critical set too quickly, except that there's no a priori critical structure. For one dimension, it's just a point where it's f prime is 0. Now I don't have it. So that's the fact is that in higher dimension, the construction is necessarily much, much more inductive. And the way it goes is like this. You look at the set, you look at the set that's good at time step 0, and you cultivate some good hyperbolic structures for the first n steps, call that good g sub n. Okay. And then you go from n to 1 over alpha n using the structures available to you on this set. Okay. So the thing is that you find this critical set inductively. Okay. And I'll show you in a moment how you will find it. Okay. You don't have a critical point. It's going to become a critical set. But I don't have the critical set either. I'm going to locate it inductively, slowly. Okay. So you don't know it ahead of time, up to time. You suppose it's okay up to time n, then you will use that and go farther. And the time scale is, again, one over alpha, because you rely on the behavior alpha n to do this. Okay. So this is the structure of the proof, and now I won't get into any of that. I just want to give you some overview of that. Okay, so what plays the role of critical point in one dimension? Okay, so first fact about linear algebra. I'm going to say this in two dimension first. In two dimension, if you take a map that is not an isometry and not a pure dilation, there's going to be a most expanded and most contracted direction. Okay. So here, green is the most expanded and red is the most contracted direction. Okay. So I'm going to look at, for the map T, I'm going to look at ESN and EUN. These are temporary stable and unstable directions. If I iterate n times, okay, what is the most contracted and the most expanded directions? Okay, so I pick out if I iterate n times forward and n times backwards, I can pick up the most contracted directions in forward time, the most contracted directions in backward time. Okay, so these are the temporary ES and EU. Okay, I can't it's all an inductive procedure, so I can't possibly know all of the all of the future, so I only have a temporary amount of information. So I think of a critical point of order n as one when EU and ES coincide. Okay. If for hyperbolicity you want them to be kind of separated, perpendicular to each other, loss of hyperbolicity is when they coincide. Okay. So I think of a Z as a critical point of order n if temporary stable direction equals a temporary unstable direction of order n. Okay, and I will try to solve for such z's. And these z's will be my approximate critical set. That's what I'm going to try to do. So just a word on what happens in higher dimension with rank 1. High dimension, rank 1 means that if you look at the derivative is a matrix of the form, really a rank 1 linear map plus something small. So locally, the picture looks like this. If you have a vector that's not contracted, then perpendicular to that, there would be a codimension, one thing that's contracted, and instead of solving for this, you will be solving for the case when the EUN is contained in ESN. Okay. But I'm going to stick to this case for today. I'm going to stick to two dimension today. Okay, so the game then is to try to solve this equation and then to pass n to infinity. And what would you have gotten if it converged to something nicely? You would have gotten a point where the stable direction is tangential to the unstable direction. That's a, what do you call that, a homoclinic orbit of some kind. Where stable direction is tangential to, is equal to the unstable direction. Now, I don't really want that. I don't want all points with this property because that's kind of messy. You know, if you have one point where the unstable is equal to the stable, where the stable and unstable directions are, stable and unstable manifolds are tangent, it's true for the entire orbit, right? So if you try to solve this everywhere, you will find stuff solutions everywhere, and it's really messy. I only want a slice of it. Okay? I only want one point of that orbit, not everything. So I'm not going to really solve this. What I'm going to do is that for n equals 1, I'm going to find a bunch of approximate solutions. And then among these approximate solutions, I will find approximate solutions for n equals 2. And then I will inside, I will find approximate solutions for n equals 3, and so on. And the intersection of all these sets will be my solution, will be my critical set. Okay. So to say this again, okay, I'm going to be this is going to be the project for the next few transparencies. I'm going to try to solve ES0 equals EU0, okay, which is, I got a lot of approximate solutions. Let's start with one. ES1 equals EU1, okay. So then I get some approximate solutions. Let's say I get a set of approximate solutions, okay. Now, I only look among this set of approximate solutions, and I try to solve ES2 equals EU2. Okay? And then I choose a subset, let's say a couple pieces inside. And then I solve ES3 equals EU3 within this set, and then it will shrink. It's a Cantor set construction, and it's going to collapse down to a Cantor set, and that's going to be, it's a fractal set, and it's going to be my critical set. It will play exactly the role of the critical point in one dimension. The derivative is conformal? No. Yeah, ESN means that if I go forward n times, n equals 1. So if I go forward, there's a direction which is contracted a lot, right? This map has some very strong contraction forwards, right? So I pick out one direction, and now I look backwards, okay? And there's a direction that's contracted the most. But this time it's not contracted by that much, okay? So, and these two happen to coincide, okay? They're headed for a point that where the stable and unstable manifolds coincide. So I'm kind of okay. Yes. No, not this equation. But in the end, if you get to the end, when n's gone to infinity, if everything passes nicely to something, then you will get the point where the stable manifold is tangent to the stable manifold, right? And that's true for the whole orbit. So if I try to solve this, I may find lots and lots of solutions, lots of places. So that's why I always want to solve it. I want to localize the solution. Okay, I'm going to be trying to make a Cantor set. Okay, so start construction, zeroth step. Okay, this is a two-dimensional picture. So the annulus is this whole strip is the annulus. This horizontal direction is the direction where the action is. Okay, think of vertical as pretty contracted, and horizontal is where the action is. So in particular, there is a point which I could draw. It's the critical point for the one-dimensional map. Okay, so for the zeroth approximation of the critical set, you could think of it as this line, if you like. You can also think of it as a box. Okay? If you want a Cantor set construction, you should think of it as a box. Okay? If you want I will always have something, a box and something inside that will, the red lines will converge to the critical set. And this is, if you want to think about the center set construction, think of this as the approximation of the zeroth order approximation to the critical set. Okay, now n equals 1, right? So the strategy is to solve this, I'm repeating myself, EU1 equals ES1 in T of A. It has to be in the image of T of A so that I can back up, right? If it's not there, if I back up, I may leave I may not be able to back up, okay? And I'm going to solve for this inside this green box, okay? So what does it look like? This is what the picture looks like. So T of A, let's say that it's gone around twice, right? So T of A contains these two strips, okay? So I'm going to be looking, solving the for EU1 equals ES1 inside these two shaded green regions. Okay, it's only these two regions that I can back up. Okay, so first let's look at I'm only solving for approximate solutions, right? No need to be exact. So what is EU1 like? Okay, EU1 is the direction that the most contracted when I go backwards. Well, I claim that it's roughly horizontal, because if this crossed over completely, it probably didn't come from a turn, right? It came from some part that's nice, and some part that's nice will be expanded as it goes inside of here. So if the image of that would be very close to, it's a good approximation of EU1. Reason? See, if you go backwards, these maps expand violently. B is small, so when you go backwards, the maps expand violently. There are very few directions that are not expanded by too much. Well, I just told you of one that when you go forward, it's more or less normal order 1, so that must be quite close to the EU1. Okay? So EU1 is roughly horizontal. Okay? It's an approximate solution. What about ES1? Okay. Now, ES1, because this is the critical point, and the second derivative is non-zero, okay, together with this non-degeneracy condition, if you take the derivative in a horizontal direction, you get zero and first derivative zero, second derivative non-zero. If you take a derivative in a vertical direction, you get non-zero. That's a non-degeneracy condition. These two conditions together, if you go home and check, it's very easy to check, to see that this is a family of parabolas. Okay. So ES1 is a foliation locally made up of parabolas. And EU is roughly horizontal. So where they are tangent, you have two little short little lines, is this line of tangency. That's my first order approximation to the critical set. Okay, so if you like, you can think of these two short little red segments as my approximation, or you can think of these two green boxes. Okay, so the construction of the Cantor set has begun. So now I go on, and let me assume for the moment that something that cannot possibly hold. So let's suppose that the turns always stay away. Okay? The turns just never come near itself. Okay? That can't possibly be true, but let's suppose it's true for a while. Okay? So when that is the case, then what do I do? Well, this picture is an identical picture to the previous one, except that now this one is one of the boxes that I found in an n-1 step. If the turns don't come in here, then Tn of A, again, is a couple of strips that cross all the way over. Okay? And for exactly the same reason as before, EUn is, again, horizontal because the turn didn't come in, so this part has been stretched. Okay? And what about ESn? Well, I claim that ESn will remain more or less like a parabola how do I guarantee that ESn continue to look like this? That happens if the critical points are hyperbolic. If critical points are hyperbolic, if you look at the most contracted direction, it's very stable. It doesn't change very much. Think about the proof of Osler-Detz theorem. Okay. How do you find the most contracted directions? you look for, you go n steps and you look for the most contracted. You go farther and you look for the most contracted. If there's really genuine Lyapunov of exponents around, that space doesn't change. Okay? And that's what's happening here. So if you keep the critical orbits hyperbolic, it will ensure that these parabolas that were the ES1s will always be parabolas in all steps. So you're always trying to look for tangents of the parabolas with the horizontal foliation, so you find two little strips, and the picture continues. So there's no difference in the nth step and the first step for as long as the turns don't come back, if you keep the critical orbits hyperbolic. So that's the story for as long as it doesn't come back. But they do come back. You can, in fact, you can't possibly force them to not come back. They will come back. Okay. So what happens is like this. Okay. You require the turns to approach the critical set slowly. Okay. Well, how slowly? Well, there's e to the minus alpha n. They're only coming in very slowly. Well, if they come in slowly, but I shrink the size of this. See, so far I've only been cutting this way, right? I didn't shrink it sideways. If I also shrink the set sideways at a rate that's faster than e to the minus alpha n, then I will never see the turns. Okay? So as far as I'm concerned, there are no turns. Okay? And that's the construction. Okay? So this argument here is not so ridiculous for as long as I shrink the box sideways as well at a rate that's faster than the turns are allowed to approach the critical set. Okay? So I hope this gives you a little bit of the flavor of how it's done. I have to allow the turns to come in, but I also shrink the box. Not only do I cut the box thin this way, I also shrink it that way. Okay? For as long as I shrink it faster than the turns are allowed to approach the critical set, I don't see any turns. Okay. So at the end of the day, this is what you get. You will see a Cantor set construction. This is a component at time k, and you will see something. It's roughly of order, actually, b to the k, where b is the contraction. I'm just giving a little too much room here. It's more like b to the k. And then you see some number of strips crossing it. That's from the k plus 1 step. And you solve for some things inside here. And you shrink, you put the box here, which you also shrink sideways, and then you inside there you have some things crossing over, and you pick another box inside, and the dimensions are, this is b to the k, this is rho to the k, where rho and b are related like so. Rho is a lot bigger than b, and it's a lot smaller than the rate of approach of the turns. So what is the critical set like? The critical set has a layered structure to it. Okay? The structure is such that it's like the pages of a book that separate the layers, but the pages of the books are not the same sizes. So you have to get closer in before you will see. You see clearly here that it's a Cantor structure, and there is a linear structure up down, right? But also that these boxes are also being cut, but much more slowly than this is shrinking. And so that's the critical set, okay. Okay, so let me say a little bit about the one-dimensional behavior at the turns. Okay. So the map is hyperbolic away from the critical set, and when a point comes near to the critical set, this is a two-dimensional map now. I want to talk about what its derivative looks like. So let me first pick a point here very conveniently so that this is one of the boxes that I just constructed, and this is the next layer, and is in the bigger, is in the green one but not the blue one. So in other words, it's kind of to the side. Okay? So let me conveniently pick a point that's to the side of the critical set, and look at here, Z is a critical point inside. So the way that what I want to show you now is how the derivative of Z is going to follow the derivative of Z prime, except that it's in two dimensions. Okay? So what I do is like this: you take a vector V, which is roughly horizontal, and decompose it into two components. One is, let's say, vertical down, some arbitrary reference direction. The other is a direction that's tangent to one of these most contracted curves. So I take V and I write it in E is the most contracted curve, and B is some other reference curve. Okay. Then what happens is you iterate V, as you apply the derivative to V, what happens is that this part gets contracted very rapidly and disappears, and you are only left with the other one. So the derivative of the so dTz of V is roughly this component. So what is this component then? What is B here? B is roughly the angle between, if you look at the splitting, the angle, what is the size of the component B? It has to do with the angle between V and that, which is roughly the distance between these two points because it's a parabola. Okay? So if I start with the point Z, which is in a very nice position, okay, with respect, I start with a point Z, which I think of as in sort of to the side of the critical set like that, and take a vector V, which is roughly horizontal with respect to this picture, then the conclusion is that if I look at the nth iterate of this vector, it's roughly like the distance between these two points times the one-dimensional derivative. The image of the vertical one is going to become horizontal, so it looks like fn prime after that step. Should I? We could let this go or go on. But see, this is how you mimic the one-dimensional behavior. The point is that if you take the location of this point, also is important because let me just put it this way. If you take a point Z that's very much to the side and take a vector that's with this angle, then if you iterate it, it would look just like a one-dimensional map. Okay. But that is not true of all points and all vectors. Only special points in special locations and vectors at special places. Okay. So, and the idea is to show that there are enough points that have this kind of property. And so you can then relate the picture to the one-dimensional picture. So why is it good to be to the side? Okay. If it's to the side, then the one iterate later, the distance will be this distance squared, and that's needed. So if you look at a point Z, which is here, one iterate later, the distance will be Z minus Z hat squared. If you take a point here, the distance will be, one iterate later, will be Z minus Z hat. Okay? So in order to copy the one-dimensional behavior, you need Z to be in these positions, and you need the vectors to be like that in order to copy one-dimensional behavior. So let's not worry about this. And just I just want to say that the whole point is to show that there are enough orbits that have these good properties so that you can copy one dimension. Okay, so let me take let me attack this from a different angle. Okay. start again someplace else. Okay. So I want to talk about what's the difference between 1D, 2D, and ND for N bigger than 2. Okay. So in 1D, we already talked about what happens. We want to control the critical points, and then it works. Okay. So in 2D, you would say, okay, you know, critical points are some kind of critical regions. So if I take this whole thing and I will try to control it and prevent it from coming back near itself, then I'll be okay. Okay. Except that that doesn't work. That will never work. So I cheated a little bit earlier when I told you that I could keep the turns away. You cannot keep the turns away. You can never keep all the turns away, because if this turn, so in one turn it stays like this, two parabolas, and suppose it stays outside, so look at the tip of the two parabolas, it gets bigger and bigger. Okay? It gets longer and longer. The distance between the tip of the two parabola curves, the two parabolas will get farther and farther apart. And sooner or later, we'll have to come back. Right? So you cannot keep that whole turn outside, away from the critical set at all. That's simply not. That this is, to me, is the biggest difference between 1D and 2D. So for 1D, you have a finite number of points. You just keep them away. You just say that I want them to come back slowly. In 2D, you say, well, I keep that whole region away, but that region grows horizontally. So sooner or later, it's going to have to intersect the critical point. Okay? So you can't do this. So what the difference? So in two dimension, there's something special about two dimension, is that in two dimension, two dimensional regions are bounded by one dimensional curves, and if you control the boundary curves, in other words, if you look at the annulus, but you control just the top and the bottom of that annulus, and so those are curves, right? So you iterate those curves, and you prevent, in other words, if you keep this point and that point from coming back, then you will be able to control what's inside. Okay. So in two dimension, the whole theory is very much like the iterating curves, looking at the iterates of curves. Okay. Well, that does not work in N dimension, in three dimension, because in three dimension, you look at now a solid, you bend it, there's no two points that you can control that will prevent the whole thing. The boundary is a big surface, and there's no way you can keep that surface away. So you cannot reduce so easily to one dimension. Okay. So I hope at least this point is clear, that there's a difference between one and two dimension, that in one dimension you just make the point not come back. In two dimension you can't make the whole region not come back, because that region, if it stays outside, it grows horizontally. So here comes the idea of critical. So I'm going to change the viewpoint a little bit now. I want to introduce the idea of critical blobs. In other words, it goes like this. Think about this very thin object that's getting bent. Okay. Think of the entire region as just one, it's the whole region, think of it as just one orbit for finite time. Okay. This only works for finite time. That region will start to grow too big. For as long as this whole region stays together, think of it as just one orbit. Okay. And then at some point in the future when you need to, let it break up into two and start to think of it as two orbits. So this is what I do. I look at the kth component, and look at a tiny region inside, which I call BK. Okay. This region has the following properties. First of all, so I have these critical regions the nested region of boxes that I have constructed, and these BKs are also nested. So I have a nested sequence of BKs. Okay. For each K, K comes from the kth generation of the BK is from the kth box. Okay. Each BK is good for time K theta minus 1. Okay. Theta minus 1 is roughly log 1 over B. So as B goes to 0, this number goes to infinity. Okay. So depending on the size of B, this blob, I claim, behaves like a single orbit up to this time. Okay. So in what way do I mean by behaving like a single orbit? Well, the derivative at all points look the same. and the size is very, very small compared to any distance that's relevant. What's a relevant distance? What distance to critical set is relevant? So it's very, very small. The diameter of this, so for this time period, the diameter of this set is very, very small relative to anything that is significant. And also the derivative is almost identical in size. So you might as well think of this whole box, BK, as a single orbit up to time, K times something, where that something is dependent on B. And this way, the picture becomes that, so you look at the map, at first I have B1, I have a single, so suppose the one-dimensional map has two critical points, then B1 has two components. Okay. So B1 then has two components, and it works very well. As a single orbit, it works up to this time. And then it starts to become too big. It's going to cause trouble because it's going to get too big. Then I replace B1 by what's inside, namely B2, which is a couple of pieces. And B2 will be good up to this time. So the critical set starts as one critical blob. Up to a certain time scale is good. You can think of this as just a single orbit. It's kind of like a fat orbit, but it's a single orbit, but it's only got good up to this time. Okay? Starting from this time, you have to go to a finer structure. There are a couple of things inside, namely the things in the higher, inside in the deeper layer. And each one of those things, these two things will be good up to two times that. The generation 2 ones would be good up to 2 times that. And again, they start to grow big, so you kind of think of it as like one orbit, bloop, becomes 2 at some time scale, bloop, becomes 4, becomes 8, like that. Okay? So the picture of so what is the difference between these maps and a one-dimensional map then? If you start with a one-dimensional map with, say, 3 critical points, you will be looking at 3 critical orbits forever. Okay? But if you start with, as you thicken this one-dimensional map by a little bit for some b, so if b is small, this is a very big number, okay, it will be, for the first theta inverse iterate, it will be 3 critical points, it will look just like the one-dimensional map. But then at this time, it starts to look like a map with 6 critical points, and then it starts to look like a critical map with maybe 12 critical points. Okay. So the number of critical points will grow exponentially, but at a very, very slow rate, depending on b. Okay? So as b goes to 0, it hardly multiplies. If b is bigger, then it multiplies faster. Okay? So that's the picture that I wanted to show you. And so let me sort of review a little bit of what was said then, is that I talked about 3 important timescales in this picture. The first one is real time. That means I'm iterating up to time n. Okay? The number of iterates considered, okay, in the good set. The second timescale, which is much slower, is alpha n, is the good behavior of the critical orbits, okay, needed to. If you want to treat all orbits up to time n, you need. If you want to treat n orbit up to time n, you need the good behavior of everything up to time alpha n. It's the history that you are copying. It's the length of the history. See, these things keep copying their own histories. So you need the histories to be good up to time alpha n in order to develop the picture up to time n. Okay. So there are 2 different timescales there. And then there is a third timescale, which is theta. Theta is the time scale in which the critical blobs multiply when they reproduce. They cannot be regarded as a single blob forever, so they slowly divide, and the rate at which they divide is at theta n. Okay. So to show you how this comes in, okay, I didn't show you how to do this. I'm just telling you that this is the way it works. Okay. That if you look at one dimension with one critical point, okay, if you look at the set of measures that's deleted after some long argument, you will see that it goes something like that. It's really is the sum of some exponentials starting with some big n. Okay, so if you look at one critical point, 1d, that's what it looks like. Don't worry about why, but that's what it looks like. So if you look at 1d with k critical points, with 3 critical points, then the amount of measures deleted would be k times that. Okay. It's not, you don't do it one at a time, but that's the answer. If you have k critical points, it will come out to be k times what you would have to do to delete one critical point. Now, what about this rank one, this higher dimensional case? In a higher dimensional case, it's as I just explained to you, this is as though this k grows slow exponentially. Well, this k grows like k to the theta n, where theta is a very, very small number. So when b is small, the number of critical blobs, the number of effective distinguishable critical points grows very, very slowly. Well, if this is slower than that, then this again sums up to be something that's small. Now, if you go to the standard map or something that's not as dissipative as this, then you will have k to the n or k to something which is much bigger than this. And this is a disaster, so you can't do any of this in the non-dissipative case. It's only good for the dissipative case. So that's... I hope this gives you a very impressionistic view of what these things look like. You know, it takes a long time to describe exactly. For one dimension, the Misrevich points are little big density points for the good parameters. Yes. Well, in more dimension, it's hard to know what you mean because you have the b. Right? For each b, it already kind of throws you off a little bit. So, yeah, I have a positive measure set around that, but I can't say that it's exactly that one. Yeah. I mean, the message that I'm trying to convey here is that these higher dimensional maps that are rank one, they look a lot like one dimensional maps, but where the number of critical points grows slow exponentially. Okay. And how slowly depends on how close it is to a one dimensional map. Mm-hmm. Well, the only thing that I try to explain is the hypervelocity of the picture, namely that when you are away from the critical set, then you have hypervelocity because you have invariant cones. When you are near the critical set, you try to look like the 1D recovery behavior. And then you have to control, but I didn't tell you what the attractor looks like, except for what the hypervelocity properties on the attractor looks like. Right. So tomorrow I will talk about something different. I think I like to tell you a little bit more about what the conditions mean, and something about the maybe how to check them. So. I don't really know what exactly is appropriate here. But the take home picture, so to speak, is that you should think of these guys as not too different from one dimensional maps, except that, you know, even if though you start with three critical points, after a while it's gonna look like you have some k to the theta n critical points. But it's the actual construction of the attractor. You don't construct the attractor, you select the maps. You select the maps that have the properties that I want, namely the critical orbits expand and they don't come back near themselves. And the attractor is simply defined to be the intersection of everything, of all the images. Yes, the properties of the attractor will be derived from these hyperbolic properties. Than in the XMA case. Why? Right? A lot more. A lot more. It's a perturbative theory. Okay. So if you want to prove, so there are two things here. One is you want to prove a theorem. The other is you want to see what the phenomenon really is. To prove a theorem, a huge amount more. It's epsilon. You cannot control it. It's bad. Okay. Huge amount. It's huge. The contraction has to be huge in order for the theorem to go through. It's a perturbative result. Okay. But if in on the other hand, if you want to look numerically and examine what the real situation is, whether you get these attractors, you don't need very much, and you already see them. So like a tenth, and you will see plenty of them. But you can't prove a theorem with a tenth. It's a perturbative result. Yes. Yes. Right. Okay. Okay. Yes. Okay. You actually brought up a very good point that for developing the dynamical picture itself, you need some contraction to beat all the other things. For example, I want my Lyapunov exponents to be stable right from the start. Okay. Remember these parabolas, I don't want them to change right from the start. Okay. That requires a separation of scales, right? For the Lyapunov exponents to take hold immediately. You want the spectrum to be separated to have this type of properties. But it's not too bad. It's only moderate. Look at what's bad here is this. What's really bad is that you have to, in order to have any parameters left, okay, you first of all, you have actually starting with here is already bad. Okay, so you can't control this epsilon very well. This is a set of bad parameters that you have to delete. It's something. Okay, and you want this sum to add up to be less than one. Otherwise, you've deleted everything, right? Yeah, okay. So in order to have something left, you want to start at a very big n. Okay, and that means you stay outside for a very long time. This is the initial stretch, right? You force it to stay outside for a very, very, very long time to build up all the hyperbolicity. Otherwise, I could delete everything. Okay, this is one thing that's bad. And then, well, this isn't so bad. This is the main thing that's bad. So the worst, this causes the, how do you keep the whole turn, the whole critical set to be out there and stay there for as long as you need to beat this? And that causes the B to be very small. You start with one, yes. Depending on the map, yeah. Depending on the map.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, possibly, yes. Now, on the other hand, all this is in some sense fake, right? Why do you have to be near this map? You could be near another map, right? So, right? So the in order for the proof to go through, you take one-dimensional map and you want to stay so close to it, right? That how I can't quite. It depends on the properties of that one-dimensional map, and how things change when you vary parameter and so on. Yes, it's on the order of, like, for the proof, it's on the order of maybe 1 millionth or something like that. I don't really know. But if you play with it numerically, you will see the attractors with 1/5, 1/10, something like that.
But not 1/10?
No, nowhere close, no. It's a strong contraction. Yes. Contraction is uniform for.
Yes.
Okay. So you take some you take the quadratic family, and you are asking whether this B can be taken. No, depending on the Misarevich, I don't know. Depending on the Misarevich, it may depend on the Misarevich point. Okay. It may depend on the Misarevich point. Okay. So some Misarevich points are closer to being not necessarily rich than others. So for those, you may need more contraction to control. As well as the parameters and so on. Okay. Yeah. To just carry the dynamical picture through is not so bad. You need some contraction, but it's not so bad. The worst part is really here. to build up an initial thing before the whole thing can get going is what really causes the problem.
Is this what you're supposed to explain as this miracle, how this one parameter of family you can control with infinitely many critical points?
You want to understand? Actually, maybe maybe you should tell me what you would like to hear about. Right? Yeah? You want to?
Understand that question? How come you can control so
Okay. Yes, this is what I'm. Yes, this is what. This is the explanation for that. You never think infinitely many critical points, or you are not going to go anywhere. At any one point in time, there's only a finite number of critical blobs. Okay. There's only a finite number of critical points at any one point in time, and that's really important. The number, however, grows slow exponentially. So dealing with k and dealing with this k and dealing with k to the theta n, where theta is really, really small, it's not too different. That's why you can control it. And this is also one place where the theta has to be small, right? In order to, so that this thing still is summable. Yeah, you should never think about this whole Cantor set as each orbit doing something different. The picture is entirely out of control. You know, no, don't do that. It's only a finite number of blobs, but it increases.